when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to Shemayim to receive the Torah, the Malachi Asharis attempted to stop him. The Malachi Asharis did not want to allow the Torah to be given to man, and Chazal explained to us why. Learning Torah is the spiritual fuel for the world, and up until that time, the Malachim, the upper celestial beings, were responsible for maintenance of physicality. Everything physical is based on the spiritual. Everything spiritual is based on the level of Kedusha. And Limud HaTorah, learning of Torah, is the spiritual fuel. And the Malachim were responsible for maintaining that level. But now in history, there was to be a change. This moment was to be the Mesirah, the giving over. The learning of Torah was now to be given to man, and the Malachim were not interested in that. Why? Because if man learns, fine and well, but what if he stops? What if he neglects? What if he's no longer interested in learning? The very kiyuma, the very existence of physicality, of spirituality, of everything will cease to be, because the energy source, the Torah, which keeps it in existence, will cease being. And therefore, Malachim attempted to stop Moshe Rabbeinu from receiving the Torah. And the Medrash tells us that Hashem said to Moshe, give them an answer. Tell them why, in fact, they have to allow the Torah to be given to man. And Moshe Rabbeinu turned to these Malachim and said, when Avram served meat and milk, didn't three of you eat them? Didn't three of you eat the meat and milk that Avram served? And when Moshe Rabbeinu said this, Miyad Hodu, immediately they agreed, and the dispute was put aside. Now this Medrash is very, very difficult to understand. It seems to be clear that because Moshe accused them of eating meat and milk, violating the Torah, immediately they agreed that, in fact, the Torah cannot be by the Malachim, has to be by man. Now, this Medrash is very difficult to understand because let's start with the following observation. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of groups of Malachim. Each group of Malachim has millions, if not billions, of celestial beings. There are 10 different categories. There are an untold myriad numbers of Malachim. Let's say you're right. Let's say that three Malachim out of these untold number of Malachim sinned. So what? Why does that prove that all of the Malachim as a group cannot have the Torah because just three of them sinned? But number two, this event happened 400 years before Kabbalah's Torah. Avram Avinu with the three Malachim was hundreds of years earlier. So three Malachim violated the Torah hundreds of years ago. That's a reason why the Malachim can't keep the Torah? But if you'd like to hear the final point, let's assume for a moment that for some reason violating the Torah is a reason why a group as a whole cannot have the Torah. Well, I dare say that in the thousands of years that we've had the Torah, probably more than three men have eaten basar b'chalav, have eaten meat and milk together. So the question is, what exactly is it that Moshe Rabbeinu said? What was it about the fact that the Malachim ate meat and milk that all of a sudden, miyad hodu, immediately they agreed? And to understand this Medrash, I think we have to better understand ourselves. We're very quick to say things like, well, I slipped, I made a mistake, I guess I overreacted, I guess I did things without thinking. But the reality is that we don't spend anywhere near enough time understanding why it is that we do things. The human being is extraordinarily complex. And the reality is that you and I have two very, very different sides to us. If you catch me in the right mood, I could be the nicest, kindest guy in the world. Sweet, magnanimous, generous, lovely person. Catch me in the wrong mood, and I could be a creep, a louse, a nasty, selfish person. Catch me in the right time of mode, and I can be very, very patient. I can have untold amount of patience. Catch me in the wrong mood, and I'm very short-tempered. But here's the strange part. It's me, one human being. I'm not some Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And one minute I'm nice, next minute I'm not. One minute I'm generous, next minute I'm stingy. And the reality is that we human beings are very complex, and beginning to understand ourselves is something that requires very, very deep wisdom. The Chovos HaLevavos in Shaar Avodas Elokim, Perek Beis, explains to us why it is that we human beings are so contradictory. He explains that when Hashem made man, Hashem took two distinct, diverse parts and mixed them together. Within me, within the I who am thinking, the I who am speaking, there's a part that's pure chelik elokim mimal, pure godly neshama. There's a part of me that only wants to be generous, a part of me that only wants to give, a part of me that deeply, deeply cares about other people. That's my neshama. That's what he calls the seichel, the wise part, the nefesh ha-sichli. But within me, there's also another part. Within me, there's a nefesh ha-bahami, an animal soul. Within the animal are all the instincts that are needed to keep it alive. The animal has all of the drives necessary to keep itself alive as well as the rest of the species. And within Adam, within me, there is a nefesh ha-bahami with all of the drives, appetites, and inclinations necessary to keep myself alive and bring about the next generation. But the reality is that there are two distinct parts of me, two diverse elements, and I am a combination of both. And to understand this combination, we need to tease them apart. We need to focus on what the chelik elokim imal, the neshama, what he calls the intellectual soul, the nefesh ha-sichli, and what the nefesh ha-bahami, the animal soul, is. So let's begin with the second part. Let's begin with the animal soul, and let's see if we could better understand it. When I was in yeshiva, there was a fellow who was in the high school who had a very difficult time with Out Shabbosim. Every 6 weeks or so, there was an Out Shabbos, and when he would go home, he had the following problem. You see, when he was a young boy, his father bought him a puppy, and this boy and the puppy kind of grew up together, and they became very attached one to the other. Whenever this fellow would go home for an Out Shabbos, his dog, now grown, would run up, and in its excitement, it hadn't seen its master in 6 weeks. It was so excited, so happy, so to speak, that it would relieve itself all over his master's pants legs. Now, this fellow was glad to know that his dog showed allegiance, but he wasn't very happy with the result. But here's the point. If you've ever owned a pet, certainly a dog, you'll note that the dog has almost a personality. It certainly forms attachments, and it certainly exhibits certain behaviors, certain inclinations. Every animal has a nefesh. It has a live, vibrant part to it that Hashem programmed with all of the instincts, desires, and appetites needed to keep it alive. Now, it's not wisdom, it's not seichel, but it has the instincts to do that which it needs to remain. The robin hungers for the worm. The cat hungers for the mouse. The robin doesn't say, based on the general availability as well as the nutritional value of the worm, I think I'll use it as my food staple. It has a natural hunger and appetite for the worm. Hashem implanted into the nefesh ha-bahami, into the animal soul, all of the instincts that it needs to stay alive. And sometimes those instincts are rather impressive. National Geographic wrote about the following, that some biologists were studying the Siberian tiger, and they found a few tiger cubs that had been orphaned almost at birth. The mother apparently had been killed, and these biologists brought in these cubs at a very young age into the laboratory and began feeding them bottled milk. As these cubs began growing, the biologists recognized that they had a problem. They could only keep the cubs for so long, and there was no mother who could reintroduce these cubs into the wild. So as the cubs grew, eventually they got to the point when they were too large to keep any longer. So the biologists released them into the wild, knowing that, well, whatever will be, will be. And this is what they found. When they released these cubs into the wild, almost immediately, the now more grown cubs began hunting, stalking deer. They found the ideal food source, but instinctively they knew how to crouch, they knew how to pounce, they knew how to kill, and they knew how to devour which part first, because implanted within the animal soul of the Siberian tiger are all of the instincts that it needs to keep alive. It doesn't need a mother to train it. It didn't have anyone there to teach it. But Hashem put into it all of the instincts to hunt, track, and take down its natural food source. You'll find many, many sophisticated behaviors within the animal kingdom. Emperor penguins are a good example. In the South Arctic, it is frigid, frigid beyond frigid. And one of the rules of life there is that everything must maintain a certain level of warmth. Now, the emperor penguin has an interesting mating system. The female will lay a very large egg. But then the female has to go feed, because once that egg hatches, it has to have a milk supply that will last. And it might not be able to eat for days on end, so it has to build up a supply of blubber, of fat, that it could convert on a regular basis to milk. So what happens in the South Arctic is that the female emperor penguin will lay this large egg. She will then keep it on her feet and saddle over, sort of kind of shimmy over to the male. The male will put his 2 feet together. The female will put the egg, deposit the egg onto the male's feet. The male has sort of a pouch made of leather and fur that covers it. And the male will stand there with the egg balanced on its feet, keeping the egg warm to incubate it, while the female will then go back to the watering hole, back to a crack in the ice, and to try to eat fish and etc. to build up its fat supply. But here's the point. The male will stand there with this egg on its feet days on end. If the egg touches the ice, it'll crack, it'll never form into a live penguin. The male will stand there for weeks on end, months on end. It literally loses 25% of its body fat, almost starving to death, waiting for the female to go feed, waiting for the female to consume enough fish, and then come back long after, weeks, sometimes month later, to come back and eventually be the food source, the milk supply for the then hatched baby. But here's the point. The emperor penguin doesn't think. It doesn't know and isn't aware of what's going to be and what's not going to be. It may never have been through this experience before. It probably is unaware of it. But instinctively, intuitively, there's a desire for the male to stand there, for the female to go feed, and then the female will come back. Mother bears will defend its young. All of the animals in the wild kingdom have all of the tools, the aptitude, and the instincts to do that which is necessary for their survival, as well as the survival of the next generation. Within man, Hashem implanted a nefesh habahami. Within me, there are all of the instincts, all of the desires to keep myself alive, as well as bring about the next generation. These are pure hungers, passions, instincts, desires. They're not intelligent. They're not thought out. They're exactly that. Hungers, appetites, and instincts. And within me, there's another part, very separate and very diverse. Within me, there's a wise seichel. There's a part of me that thinks and understands. There's a part of me that wants to be generous and helpful. There's a part of me that wants to serve my Creator, that wants to be close to my Creator. And there's a part of me that couldn't care less. The I, whom thinking, am made up of two very distinct parts. You see, when I think about davening Shemona Esrei, there is a part of me that literally feels that I'm standing in front of my Creator right here, speaking to Hashem, having a conversation with the Creator of the heavens and the earth, and there's a half of me that can't see Hashem at all. You see, the nefesh habahami, the animal instinct within man, only sees that which is immediately in front of it. But more than that, there's no wisdom to it. There's no intellect. It's pure appetites, hungers, and desires. It can't see the future. It can't see that which is hidden, and anything that's not within its framework of desires, appetites, and inclinations doesn't exist. So the I who am thinking, the I who am alive, am made up of two very, very distinct, two very, very different parts. And those two parts are constantly fighting. One or the other is going to become dominant over the person. You see, much like a muscle that with use becomes stronger, with disuse atrophies, each part of me, the Nefesh HaBahami, as well as the Nefesh HaSichli, if I use it, it becomes stronger. If I don't use it, it becomes weaker. So in reality, the I am made up of these two parts that are constantly changing. One or the other is going to become dominant. One or the other is going to become more powerful. And the I who am thinking, the I who am in the middle over here, constantly have a different sense of reality, a different sense of feeling. I look at things differently. I feel differently based on what I do. And this concept is one of the most basic ideas that a person has to understand if they wish to understand themselves. If you use one part, it becomes stronger. If you use the other part, it becomes stronger. And the Chovos Levavos explains to us, that if left to his own devices, the Nefesh HaBahami would become dominant almost completely within man. You see, all day long, you're eating, you're sleeping, you're being involved in this world. And what that means in plain language is that all day long, that part of you, the Nefesh HaBahami, the animal soul, is being exercised. It's being used. You're constantly eating, you're constantly sleeping, you're earning a living, or you're doing whatever you're doing in this world, you're constantly using the Nefesh HaBahami. And the Nefesh HaBahami becomes stronger and stronger, and if left in that natural state within a short amount of time, the Nefesh HaBahami would be dominant, and man would be an animal in human form, maybe a bit more intelligent, but dominated by appetites, instincts, without the ability to control him. You see, in the Nefesh HaBahami, there are no controls. When a dog feels the need to procreate, it will do incredible things. If you speak to pet owners, cats will jump through plate glass windows, and dogs will claw under fences. When it goes into heat, there's no controlling agent. There's nothing that stops it. It just becomes pure passion, pure desire, pure need, and it will do whatever is necessary, even at its own expense, sometimes dying, and sometimes causing itself tremendous damage, because there's no wisdom, there's no understanding. The Nefesh HaBahami, the animal soul, only sees that which is goloi umiyad, that which is revealed and immediate. If it's right in front of me, I see it. If it's immediate, I see it. The dog won't jump into a fire to satisfy its desire, but if two steps away, it'll end up being burnt to death or whatever. It doesn't understand it. It won't see it, and it will cause itself tremendous damage because there's no wisdom and there's no controlling agent, no ability to hold itself back. And if you'd like to understand the I, I'd like to give you a mushel. Imagine that there are two circles. These two circles overlap. One is white and the other is black. And imagine for a minute that they completely overlap. Depending on the percentage of the white or the percentage of the black will be the total color. Now, imagine for a minute that the white is 100% full and the black is just 10%. It's a gray scale. It's scaled down dramatically. So when the two circles overlap, you're going to get a mostly white sort of color with slight tones of maybe a little bit of gray in it. Imagine the opposite. Let's say the black was 100%, full solid black, and the white was very washed out. It was only 10%. So when you overlap those two circles, what you're going to get is mostly black with just a little bit of lightning, but not much more. Imagine for a minute that the I whom thinking am comprised of these two circles, the Nefesh HaBahami, Nefesh HaSichli, where the Behemoth is black, the Nefesh HaSichli is white, and these two circles overlap. So imagine for a minute that both of these circles start at 50%. So because both start at 50%, you have 50% black, 50% white, and when the two circles overlap, I sort of kind of have this hazy sort of grayish sort of view of life, and I'm influenced by that. Now, the more I exercise one or the other, the stronger it becomes. So imagine for a minute that I give in to the behemoth all the time. I give in and give in, give in and give in. The black becomes much, much stronger. Instead of 50%, it becomes 60, becomes 70, becomes 80. And because I don't exercise the Nefesh HaSichli, the white becomes lighter and lighter. Eventually, my whole view of the world becomes very, very blackened and very, very darkened. Now, everything that we do strengthens the Nefesh HaBahami. What strengthens the Nefesh HaSichli? So the Chovos HaVavos explains to us that there are not many things at all that strengthen the Seichel. He explains that the Torah gave us very specific mitzvahs that strengthen him. Chesed strengthens the Nefesh HaSichli. You see, when you ask me for a favor, there's a full half of my personality that says, why in the world should you care about anyone but yourself? What do you care about him? Take care of yourself. When someone comes to me and asks for tzedakah, there's a full half of my personality that screams, why are you taking your hard-earned money? You need that money. Why are you giving it to him? Take care of you. You need it. And when I do something for someone else, my Nefesh HaBahami screams out, what are you doing? And that's an example of the Nefesh HaSichli being exercised, where my Seichel, my intellect, my understanding is exercising. I'm saying I'm doing something for someone else, and that makes it stronger. Chesed, tzedakah, davening makes the Nefesh HaSichli stronger. However, explains the Chovos HaVavos, the single most impactful, most potent nutrient for the Seichel, for the neshama of man, is Limud HaTorah. Learning Torah is spiritual nourishment. It's nuclear fuel. It empowers the neshama. In that balance between the Nefesh HaSichli and the Nefesh HaBahami, it becomes strengthened. It lights up. It's given a tremendous amount of energy. Why is that? Because the Torah, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu's thoughts, the most holy, sublime, highest level of Kedusha, and when you infuse your mind with them, when you think in those terms, your neshama starts glowing, becomes more prominent, becomes stronger. Do you ever wonder why it is that so much of learning has little to do with real life? If you ever spend time in yeshiva, you'll know many mesechtas deal with concepts that have no application in our world. Shor shenagach hazapara. I never owned a cow. My cow never gored another cow. Yet I'll spend a year learning the halachas. Sukkah agav sukkah. One sukkah on top of another. I don't ever remember seeing one sukkah built on top of another. The entire parashas in the Torah, ir nidachas, ben sora mora, that never happened and never will happen. So why in the world would Hashem want us to learn these things? And again, the Chovos HaVavos explains to us that many, many of these portions of the Torah are because they teach us Das Torah, Hashem's thought process, but more than anything, they cause my neshama to glow, and they give me strength. They're Hashem's approach to life, if it could be, and the Das Elyon, the higher level thinking, infuses me with strength and energy, and it causes me to become more sichli, more holy. The reality is that you and I are in constant flux, constant change, and whichever part of us we exercise, whichever one comes to the fore, becomes more dominant and becomes more of us. But we're constantly changing. Those two overlapping circles are either becoming blacker or whiter, but we're changing constantly. Now, the reality is that the way we feel is based on the balance. You ever notice you could be in shul on Yom Kippur and you can have such a clarity of understanding? I get it. Hashem created me to grow, to accomplish. I'm here in this world for a few short years. Every mitzvah is so powerful. And every mitzvah changes me and changes the world. And with that understanding, you make commitments and you take on a whole different path in life. And then comes Matzah Yom Kippur and comes the next day and it's gone. Gone. What happened? What happened was you reached a certain level of clarity, a certain level of understanding. It wasn't permanent, but in that flex between the black and the white, for whatever the reason, the white became much more potent and much more dominant, and you were able to see things differently. You're able to feel about things differently. Now, the question that begs being asked is, why in the world would Hashem create us in this way? Why would Hashem make it so difficult for us to see what's important, what's significant? Why is it that many a day we'll wake up and we just don't care? Learning, davening, whatever. Doing mitzvahs, whatever. Why is it that we're made up of these two parts? And why is it that they're constantly changing? What do we need, the black and the white? Just take the neshama, put it into man, and life would be wonderful. And the answer to this is based on understanding Bechira. Free will is a concept that's bandied about, that's thrown about, and very few people fundamentally understand it. And I'll explain to you what I mean. Ask a yeshiva bocha the following question. Does a malach have Bechira? Fine question. Does a malach have free will? Every yeshiva bocha will tell you, of course not. Everyone knows malachim don't have free will. Man has free will. Angels don't. Unfortunately, that yeshiva bacha is wrong. Malachim have free will. You'll see many examples in Chazal where malachim made mistakes and were punished. And when the malach came to destroy Sodom, Gavriel told Lot about what he was going to do. He wasn't supposed to do that. And because he made a mistake, he was sent on the mechitz of Hashem for a certain amount of time. The point is that you'll see many, many times when malachim choose incorrectly and are punished. And if you'd like to understand the difference between a man and a malach, it's not that man has free will and a malach doesn't. Both have free will, but there's a very different distinction between them. And to illustrate what that distinction is, let me give you a mashal. Here's the question. Do you have free will to put your hand in a fire? Right? Imagine I pull out a crisp $100 bill and say to you, this $100 bill is yours if you put your hand in a fire for 60 seconds. Now, I was a high school rebbe for enough years to know that guys are going to ask, well, rebbe, what about $50 for 30 seconds? What about 15 seconds? Could be $10? You know, I guarantee that if I were to offer you $100 or $1,000 or $10,000, you wouldn't put your hand in a fire for a minute. Why? Because it's damaging. It destroys your hand. Your flesh will burn off of your bone and you'll be permanently damaged. It's destructive, and you would never do it. Could you do it? Yeah, I guess you could, but you never would, because it's foolish. That's the type of free will that a malach has. You see, a malach sees with absolute, total clarity of thought. An angel understands that everything that Hashem commanded is for the good. Hashem is the meitiv. Hashem is the giver. Hashem only wants to give. Hashem created the whole world to give. And everything that Hashem manifests is through love, giving, kindness. And so a malach wouldn't violate Hashem's will. Why? Because it sees it as damaging. Hashem commanded me to do this because it's for my good or for the good of the world. And why would I do something like put my hand in a fire? Whenever you see a malach making a mistake, it's what we call a mistake in cheshbon, in judgment. And sometimes a malach will act too much in the honor of Hashem, feeling the zealousness of Hashem's covered too much. Sometimes a malach will make a certain miscalculation. But you see, a malach sees with absolute total clarity the effects. Every mitzvah causes me to grow, causes me to shine for eternity. Every avera damages me. So do malachim have free will? They have the kind of free will that I have to put my hand in a fire. Meaning, in theory they could, but in practicality they wouldn't. And that's not the kind of free will that Hashem wanted to give to man. You see, Hashem put us on this planet to grow, to accomplish, to be challenged, to make ourselves into what we will be for eternity. But that's the problem. There's a part of me, the neshama, that's brilliant, that's insightful, that understands the consequences. My neshama sees with absolute clarity, as a malach does, that every mitzvah that Hashem commanded me is for my good. It helps me. I change. I'm happier in this world and elated in the world to come. And every avera damages me. Why should I do it? Why should I damage myself? Why should I hurt myself? And so if Hashem took the neshama, put it into a guf, put us here in this world, we would have the kind of free will that malachim have, meaning in theory we would have free will, but on a practical level, we wouldn't. And therefore, to allow for practical free will, Hashem also put into us a nefesh abahami, an animal soul. And now there are two parts to me. There's a part that's brilliant and insightful, and a part that's dumb as sin. There's a full half of my personality that only sees that which is immediately in front of it. There's a full half of my personality that hungers for things, whether they're good for me or not. There's a full half of me that wants things without rhyme, without reason, without intellect, and maybe without cause, but it hungers and desires, needs them, has to have them. And the I who am thinking am made up of these two very distinct parts, these two very, very different parts of me. And the Chovos HaVavos explains that once you understand this, you'll understand the tam, the underlying reason of many, many mitzvahs in the Torah. Let's begin with one. If you take meat that's shechted properly, salted, and is 100% kosher, and you eat it, it's fine, it's wonderful. If you take milk from a kosher animal and you drink it, 100% fine. Take that meat and that milk, mix them together, boom, all of a sudden, basar b'chalav. Take wool, make a garment out of it, fine and wonderful. Take linen, make a garment out of it, fine and wonderful. Mix them together, all of a sudden, oh, shatnez. Why? Explains the Chovos HaVavos that there are different things that you do in this world that strengthen either the nefesh abahami or the nefesh asichli. Chazal tell us that treif food is metamtem the lev, it deadens the heart. Klei Yakar explains we don't eat predators. All of the kosher animals, none of them are predators. Why? Because when you eat the animal, you eat the meat of the animal, part of the nefesh remains in it. And if you eat a predator, the nature of a predator is to be cruel, achzar, to be aggressive. And if you ingest that into you, part of that gets into your neshama, and you feel differently. Western civilization is very sophisticated in some areas of knowledge, but they're clueless in others. And basar b'chalav changes the balance of I. It makes my heart feel things differently. Eating treif food deadens my heart. It makes it more difficult to feel the holiness of Shabbos. It makes it more difficult to feel Hashem's presence. It makes it more difficult to feel another Jew's pain. And I've seen this many a time. When I learn with people who are not from, I could tell almost immediately. You tell them over a certain concept, you could see there's a deadness. There's a heaviness of the heart. There's fat covering up. They can't feel it. They can't hear it. Because treif food does that. It deadens. It's just a metzias. The Chovos HaVavos explains that many, many of the prohibitions of the Torah are because they give a special force, a special strength to the nefesh habahami. When you eat treif food, it makes the nefesh habahami stronger. And when you live with forbidden relations, it makes the nefesh habahami stronger. When you wear shatnez, it makes the nefesh habahami stronger. They're called a chok. They're called a chok in the sense that you have to be a scientist of the soul to understand how it affects the balance. But explains the Chovos HaVavos, every one of these prohibitions change the balance in man. Hashem wants us to grow. Hashem wants us to accomplish. Hashem wants to allow our nefesh asichli to come to the fore, to be brilliant and powerful and vanquish, win out over the nefesh bahami. And if Hashem warns us against certain isurim, and certain prohibitions, because they give an inordinate amount of strengthening to the nefesh bahami, therefore the Torah warns us about foods, about clothing, about different activities that we do, and because it would make the nefesh bahami stronger. And this also helps us understand another very, very important concept. Arguably, the holiest day in the Jewish calendar is Yom Kippur. It's a day of slicha u'mechila. It's a day that's prepared for a person to reach out to his Creator. It's a day when you can sense Hashem's presence much more clearly than you would the rest of the year. Now, wouldn't you imagine if it's the holiest day of the year, a day that we really need to focus and really use our full strength, wouldn't you imagine the Torah would command us, eat a good breakfast. Before you come to shul, make sure you fill your stomach. Make sure that you're really strengthened because you have a whole day of davening, of tshuva, klapping al chet, you have a whole day of work. Make sure that you eat a good breakfast, have a good lunch because you need your strength, you need your energy. Make sure that you're prepared for the work that you're going to do. And strangely enough, that's not what the Torah says. V'nisem es nafsho seichem. You're not allowed to eat, you're not allowed to drink. You have to afflict yourself. Why in the world would the Torah want us to do that on the most important, holiest day of the year? And again, the Chovos HaLevavos explains to us because what it does is it weakens the Nefesh HaBahami. You'll start feeling it maybe around 2 o'clock in the afternoon when the fast starts to kick in. There's a certain weakness. You see, you haven't fed the body in quite a number of hours. And as a result, the body is a little bit weaker. And because the body is a little bit weaker, it has less sway, less control. And as a result, I'm able to see things with a different clarity. I feel differently. I look back on my year with a different sense. I now understand things with a totally different perspective. Why? Because my nefesh ha-sichli is able to come out. Because in those two circles, the black circle, at least temporarily, became less dark, less strong. The nefesh ha-bahami is weaker, and I'm able to view things differently. I'm able to understand things with a different perspective. And that's why the Torah warns us not to eat on Yom Kippur, so that you could be ready to grow. And this is also the answer, I believe, for the malachim. Do you know why these malachim miyad hodu? Immediately they agreed. And Moshe Rabbeinu said to him, don't you understand? You ate, three of you ate basar b'chalav. Would a malach do something that damages itself? No. A malach would never do that. A malach wouldn't do something that damages itself because it's clear and understand things clearly. Yet you ate meat and milk. Why? Do you know why? Because it didn't damage you. You don't have a guf. You don't have a nefesh ha-bahami. A malach is pure seichel. A malach is intellect. A malach doesn't have a nefesh ha-bahami. Therefore, it's not forbidden to eat basar b'chalav because basar b'chalav is forbidden to man. Man is in balance. Man has an animal soul within him, and it's the animal soul that the mitzvahs are directed to because there are various activities that strengthen the seichel and various activities that strengthen the nefesh ha-bahami. And as soon as a malachim heard that, miyad hodu, even if it was only three of them, even if it was hundreds of years ago, they immediately agreed the mitzvahs of the Torah are given to man. Man who is this strange being, this being in utter contradiction, this dichotomy of pure spirituality and total physicality mixed up to this entity called man, the mitzvahs apply because man is in constant change, constant flux, and that's why Hashem gave us the mitzvahs. And this concept, I believe, is fundamental to understanding everything that we do and certainly fundamental to understanding ourselves. And I believe it especially is applicable when we're dealing with an issue called taiva, called desire, towards trying to understand ourselves and trying to master ourselves and work on this area. And let me try to explain what I mean specifically. When my son Shalom Ari was a little guy, he used to like reading science fiction books. One of the series that he was into was called Animorphs. Animorphs is, again, science fiction story, and in the Animorphs is something called a yerk. What's a yerk? A yerk is this little slug, this little tiny sort of wormy kind of thing. And what the slug does is it climbs in your ear, and then it enters your brain, and it takes control. It takes over your body. So what happens is the slug enters your ear, and you'll want to go left, and the slug says, uh-uh, we're going right, and you go right. You want to go forward, and the slug says, uh-uh, we're going back, and you go back. the slug takes over and you become effectively like a puppet. It controls you and you just go through the motions. So my son, Shlomai, when he was little, said to me, Abba, isn't that a great mushel? And that's a great mushel to the Yetzer Hara. When the Yetzer Hara takes over, you want to do this, but it won't let you. You don't want to do that, and it makes you. Isn't it a great mushel? Now, he was a little guy, and the job of a father is to properly bring up his children, especially give them a good sense of self. So I said, yes, Shlomai, it's a very good mushel, very good. I'd like to share with you that that's a terrible mushel, and I'll share with you why. You see, when the yerk says go left, you want to go right, but you have to go left against your will. When the yerk says go right and you want to go left, you go right against your will. You want one thing, it wants another, and it wins. But when the Yetzer Hara takes over, it's not that it wants to do something and you don't. I now want to do it. You see, it's I who am comprised of these two parts. And when the Nefesh HaBahami takes over, I, the totality of I, now want to do that. And if you'd like to fundamentally understand yourself, you have to understand that the two overlapping circles are a little bit more complex. Let's go back to those two circles. We have the white circle, which is the Nefesh HaSichli. We have the black circle, which is the Nefesh HaBahami, and they overlap. So depending on which is stronger and which is more powerful will determine whether it's whiter or blacker in the circle. But now imagine that around both of those circles, there are many dots. And those dots are our midos, different desires, appetites, character traits. There might be gaiva, there might be arrogance, there might be anger, there might be jealousy, there might be selfishness. There might be all of the midos, all of the character traits and desires that make us up. And let's watch what happens. Let's imagine that I'm in a bad mood and you said the wrong thing to me at the wrong time. So that little dot called anger suddenly flares up. But what happens is it started as a little red dot sort of on one side of the two overlapping circles, but now it expands and it now covers up the entire circle. And now I'm angry. I'm furious. I'm bekas. And that little red dot now expanded, so it took over the entire circle, and the I am now angry. Now, anger will expand or contract, and depending on whether you work on it or don't, it will determine what happens. So let's imagine a person has a problem with anger, and they tend to get angry often. What will happen is the anger will grow. So what that means in our mushel sense is that little dot, it'll become much easier for it to expand. It no longer took what it used to take to get it to fully expand. It takes less and less. And when it's fully expanded, it's deeper red. It's no longer like a light pink that it started, and now a deeper, deeper red. And when it recedes, it takes longer to recede. You see, all of us start with midos at different levels. I might have anger at a level 10, you might have it at a level 20. I might have arrogance at level 20, you may have it at level 10. But if you imagine all of the midos, all of us start with them at different points. So let's look at anger for a minute and look at it as a red dot. And imagine a guy started with it as a 10. If he started with a 10, it took a good amount to get that little dot to expand to the full circle. It might have taken someone insulting him, someone really being nasty. But once he allowed it to happen once, it's a little bit easier the next time for it to expand, kind of like a balloon. Once you blow it up the first time, it's easier the next time and the next time to blow it up because it just lost some of that elasticity and it became easier to blow it up. So if a fellow gives into his anger once, it's sort of easier for it to become bigger. He gives in twice, it's easier. And every time he gives into that anger, it becomes easier and easier for it to expand to the full circle. It also gets darker and darker so that when it expands, it's not a 10% pink, but it's now 20% or 30% or it's becoming 50%. And for it to recede takes even more. And what happens with anger is the more you give into it, the angrier you get, the easier it is to be angry, and the harder it is to appease you. But this is the point. Anger changes. The solution to anger really is quite simple. Don't get angry. If you don't get angry, what happens is it starts becoming weaker. No longer is it so easy for it to just fully expand. When it expands, it no longer covers up quite as much. And when it does cover up, it recedes more quickly. The solution to anger is not to get angry. The way to destroy yourself, the way to really develop a fierce temper, is to allow yourself to give into it. The more you give into it, the more that red dot becomes quick to expand, the more thick and dark the red becomes, and the harder it is to get rid of it. And if we were discussing anger, and there are many shmuzim that discuss anger management, shmuz number 30, if you want to work on anger, it's important to focus on it and understand it. But we're discussing something a little bit different. We're talking about taiva, desire. And taiva works very much the same way. Imagine for a minute that on our overlapping circles, we have something called taiva. Again, it's a dot. Let's call it a blue dot. What happens here is very, very interesting. It starts at a certain level. Now, different things will trigger it, different things will excite it, different times of the year, different ages will bring it out more or less. But what happens is, the more you give into it, the easier it is for it to cover up the entire circle. And the darker that it is, and the harder for it to recede. And the more you give in, the more you give in, the more you give in, the stronger it becomes. But here's the strange part. When I allow it to take over, imagine that I'm getting involved in taiva, and I'm doing different things, and thinking different things, and looking at different things, and etc., and it becomes stronger and stronger. When it takes over, when it covers up the circle, I now desire that act. I want it. But that's a strange thing. Because 10 minutes ago, I didn't want it. 10 minutes ago, I had no interest in it. And if you'd like to understand yourself, this is one of the keys to self-wisdom. You could be standing there one day and reach a total recognition, this is destroying my life. It's destroying my happiness. It's not allowing me to function. I can't learn. I can't daven. Maybe if you're married, it's even destroying your marriage. And you say to yourself, that's it. I'm done. Finished. I will have nothing to do with taiva again. Never, ever. And in that moment of clarity, you honestly believe it and you mean it. And if you remained in that clarity, you never would sin, never be involved with this stuff ever again. But the problem is that when the circle starts to expand, all of a sudden you feel differently. You saw that image that you shouldn't have seen. Or the image came up in your brain that you didn't want to come up. And you let it linger, and you let it stay. And all of a sudden you started wanting it and started desiring it. But here's the point. You now want it. You now desire it. 10 minutes ago you swore up and down. You took 100 shvuos d'oraisa that you would never dream, never be involved in this kind of stuff. And now the very you want it and desire it. And the human being is exactly that, a very strange bria. Many years ago, I had a conversation with Rabbi Harris, Rosh Hashiva, now of Chavetz Chaim Forest Hills, and I take covet in the fact that he agreed with my hesber. There's a young fellow in Beis Medrash. I was a little bit older than him, and I was a little bit of a, what you call a Talmud Chaver. We were friends, and I tried to help him. And one day, Rabbi Harris found out that on a pretty regular basis, this fellow at night would go to a Beis Zonos. He would go to prostitutes. Now, this was 30-odd years ago, and the idea of a yeshiva guy, especially learning in yeshiva, going to a prostitute at night was like so unheard of. Rabbi Harris said to me, I don't understand. How could it be? The guy learns 2 starm a day. He learns morning seder, comes to shir, learns afternoon seder. How is it shayach? How is it possible that he goes to a basis owner to go to a prostitute at night? And I said to Rabbi Harris, I'll explain to you. This fellow had a very unfortunate situation. He was in a out-of-town school when he was growing up, and there was an English teacher, a young woman, and she took advantage of him. She invited him home to her house one day, and at a very young age, in 8th grade, he was involved in things that a bachur should never be involved in. Well, needless to say, his high school experience was very different than the average high school bachur. And by the time he got to Beis Medrash, he was fighting bitter battles. He would sit down to a Gemara, get into the Tosos, be thinking, wow, that's Tosos Kasha, that's his answer, and bingo, this image would come into his mind. Get out of here! And he'd back to the Tosos, Havamina Maskana, and there she was again. Get out of here! And back to the Ksos, back to what was going on, and the image came back. And he fought battle after battle. If you can imagine a half hour of this, trying to concentrate, and there she is, get out of here, concentrate, there she is, get out of here. And it wasn't a half hour, it was an hour. By the time he got to Shir, he was exhausted. He would go to Shir, try to listen, and there it was again, the image and the desire, and I do want, I don't want, I don't want the battle. And then would come afternoon Seder, and he'd have another 3 hours of bitter fights. We'd be into learning and love learning and want to do it, but then she comes in and... By the time 6:30 came around, the guy was exhausted. He was wiped out. He fought a whole day. So what do you expect? He ended up in the base of Zonos. But you see, that's the point. The guy did not want to go there. He wasn't saying, wow, he need mukhan mazuman. He said quite the opposite. I want to grow. I want to accomplish. I want to be pure. But these images came in his brain. And when they came, he began desiring it. Began desiring it, and that little circle expanded, covered up, and became more and more potent, more and more filling up everything, and it was he, in the end, that wanted to go there. And I believe that these concepts are fundamental to understanding where the battle lines are drawn. You see, the first concept we have to understand is that if you want to work on taiva, you can't only focus on desire. You see, I am a very complex being. I have a nefesh sichli and a nefesh bahami, and if I'm not growing, I'm in deep and sorry trouble. You see, if that white circle isn't becoming stronger and the black circle isn't becoming weaker, then I'm going to be in big, big trouble. And the first thing you need to do if you want to conquer this area, if you want to grow, is you have to understand that you need to grow in general spirituality, in general ruchnias. What that means is, in those two circles, the overlapping white and the overlapping black, you have to make it that the white is becoming more and more white, the black is becoming less and less black, and that means you have to have a program of growing, whether it be growing in learning, growing in davening, growing in chesed, growing in caring about other people, working on your midos. It has to be an overall growth system. Because if you only work on the taiva alone, you'll never win, because the black becomes stronger and stronger, and even if the taiva itself becomes weaker, you just don't see the damage, you don't see the danger, you want it more, and it's easier and easier for you to fall back into the same patterns, and you'll never win. So the first principle that I think we have to take from this chazal, and in terms of applying to this issue at hand, is the understanding that I have to be working on my overall ruchnias. It's my totality of the balance that has to change, number one. Principle number two is that you have to work on taiva itself, desire itself. Much like anger, where if you don't get angry, it becomes weaker and weaker, and the more angry you get, more often the stronger and stronger it becomes, taiva increases or decreases with use. And that's the great secret. The Yitzhar likes to tell you otherwise, but here's the reality. When you give in, yes, it's true that you're satisfied for an hour or 4 hours or a day or whatever it is, but you ever notice that the desire comes back even more strong? Chazal equated to drinking salt water. If you're really thirsty, you're pining away, and you drink a whole cup of salt water. Initially, it sates your thirst. You're not as thirsty, but there's a dryness in your throat. There's a thirst, and an hour later, you're more thirsty than you were before. When you give in to desire, what you're doing is you're making that desire more potent, stronger, and the single most effective solution is not to give in. Now, that is very easily said and very difficult to do, but at least strategically, understanding that the solution to taiva is not giving in is an understanding of the battle line. You see, the battle is fought on not giving in. And when you don't give in, don't give in, don't give in, what happens is the taiva becomes weaker and weaker and doesn't pull at you. And you have to work on the taiva itself, and the way you work on the taiva itself is by not giving in. But at the risk of sounding like I'm totally contradicting myself, let me explain to you what principle number three is. Principle number three is that you're going to feel differently at different times. Meaning to say, on Yom Kippur and Shul, you're going to see things with clarity, and you're not going to want to do those things. But when you're in those things themselves, guess what? You want it. But wait a minute, 10 minutes ago I didn't, but now I do. I don't. Well, right now, once that little circle expanded and now covers you up, you have a different perspective. You feel differently. And I need to bring in a mushel, because only with this mushel, I think, can we understand the complexity called you and I. Do you ever watch a young yeshiva guy on Purim when he gets drunk? Imagine we got an 18-year-old guy, we'll call him Shmuel. It's his first Purim that he gets drunk, and he got drunk, and he leaves the building. And you watch him. Shmuel, where are you going? I'm going to play with the cards. Shmuel, you're going to trap. I'm going to play with the cards, yeah. Shmuel, you're going to get hit by one of those cards. I know. Smack, crack, goes my back. Shmuel, one of those cars is going to hit you and it's going to send you to the hospital. I know. I'll get hit by a car. I'll go down to the doctor, put pins in my back. I'll go through the x-rays when I go to the airport. Ding, 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 ding. What's going on? Shmuel is a very intelligent fellow. And it's clear that he's processing information, because he told you about the doctor and the pins in the airport, and like, and he understands, crack the back, what's going on? Is Shmuel sane? Is he rational? What's going on? The answer is that Shmuel is drunk. His normal seichel, his normal intellect is blunted, confused. He's drunk. He doesn't see the consequences. He can say the words, get hit by the car, but he doesn't feel them. He could say the words, go to the hospital, but he doesn't recognize what that means. So he feigns, kind of looks like an intelligent, thinking person, but he's in a stupor. He's not connecting the dots. He's not with the program. He doesn't get it. And if you'd like to understand, you and I, that's us. When anger takes over, I'll do things that I never would have done before. I'm such a careful person. I'm so sensitive to other people's feelings. Until I get angry, then watch out. I'll say things and do things I never would have dreamt of. What happened? What happened is my shura sasecha, my intellect changed. But what changed? Because the red has now covered me up, and I'm now feeling differently, and I'm now drunk. Drunk with anger. Well, and Taiva works very much the same way. When my son said the yerk takes over and that's the Yetzer Hara, makes you want to do something you don't want to do, that's 100% false. And when Taiva expands, you want to do it. But wait a minute, I didn't want to do it before, but now you're drunk. Because the you view things through those two overlapping circles. See, I'm right in the middle of those two, the white and the black, and whichever media expanded and covers up, that's me now, and I feel through those. I experience the world through those. So I'm angry or filled with lust and filled with desire, and now I want it. And this is one of the main principles that you have to understand, that there are times when you're really, really going to desire never being involved in anything like this at all, and there are going to be times when you really, really want it. Which am I, normal or not? Am I Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde? I want it or I don't want it. Which one am I? The answer is, I'm both. And growth is predicated on understanding that. And growth is predicated on making decisions when you're in your right mind. And I want to give you one more mushel. Imagine we have a guy who gets drunk regularly. And when he gets drunk, he gets so drunk that he falls on his face. And on a regular basis, he breaks his nose, blackens his eye. And he's constantly looking like a war zone. And he says, this is crazy. I got to stop this stuff. Every time I get drunk, I fall on my face and bloody myself. I'm going to work on it. So what does he do? He joins a ballet class to learn better balance. He joins a yoga class to learn how to stand on one foot. All so that when he gets drunk, he won't lose his balance, won't smash his face. And that's a very foolish approach. Because if you want to not blacken your eye when you get drunk, don't get drunk. Because when you get drunk, your balance is gone. All of your yoga isn't going to help. Because your brain is not connecting. And that's the point. The first concept you have to understand is that when you're in desire, when the taiva wells up, you're not going to be thinking straight, you're going to be drunk, and you have to make your decisions way before. And you have to understand that the battle isn't fought when you're drunk. The battle isn't fought that when you're drunk, trying to keep your balance. The battle is not to get drunk. And that is a tremendous yesod. You see, the fight isn't that when I'm in lust, when I'm having taiva to resist and not do things, the battle is not to have taiva be there, not to have it control me, not to let that circle grow bigger and overarch everything else. And even though right now we're still in the world of theory, I think these three principles are yesodistic, tremendously fundamental to everything else that we're going to do. The first principle is you cannot work on taiva alone because the I am very complex. You see, a huge part of my motivation is based on how much I understand reality. If for a split second I would realize that I'm here for a few short years, every mitzvah causes me to grow and change, and every avera damages me, I'd be a lot more motivated to work. But that motivation is based on how much my seichel is functioning and how little the nefesh habahamis is blackening me. And what this chazal shows us is the reason why the malachim were immediately in agreement was because the Torah was given to man. And as the Chovos Levavos explains, Hashem made us out of two very different parts, competing parts. The nefesh ha-sichli that only wants to do what's good, what's right, what's proper. The nefesh ha-sichli is noble, magnanimous, and generous. It's beautiful. And is another half of me, nefesh ha-bahami, with the desires and appetites, much like the penguin, much like the Siberian tiger, with all of the desires and instincts to keep myself alive. And the I am in utter contradiction. But the difference between Adam and the behemoth is that in the behemoth, there's no controlling force. The behemoth has been programmed. It's implanted into the nature of the animal, all of the instincts, and there's nothing that the animal can do to override them, to change the programming. But man was given a very, very different capacity. Not only am I comprised of these two parts, but I have the tools to change. The primary tool is the Torah system of self-perfection by learning, by davening, by growing. The seichel part of me becomes more dominant, becomes stronger. The white becomes deeper. The black, being used much less, becomes weaker. And I, as a totality, become much more clear thinking, become much more understanding. And the first principle of working on these areas is you can't only work on these areas. You have to work on the totality of I. The second principle is you must work on taiva directly, because even if you become very, very white, become very, very holy, if you don't work on taiva, when that little circle expands, it covers up. It covers up the whole circle, and all of a sudden you feel differently. If it's anger, and the anger goes from pink to red to brilliant, brilliant scarlet, I feel differently, and I'm going to do things that I never would do. So you have to also work directly on the taiva. And the third principle is that the time to work on it is not when it flared up. That's too late. You have to also fight then, but the battle is way before that. The battle isn't to keep your balance when you're drunk. The battle is not to get drunk. And the battle in taiva is not to allow it to flare up, not to allow those thoughts to come into my mind, not to allow those images to be there. And in the future, Mitzvah Hashem will spend time on strategies and techniques, how to avoid them. But for now, let's keep these principles. One, I have to work on the totality. And two, I have to work on taiva directly. And three, the battle is not when I'm drunk, not to fall. The battle is not to get drunk. Don't allow the taiva to expand. Don't let it to go further.